So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, mate.
Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Guess who? Guess who? That's right. Bruiser Brody. That's right. Cowboy Bill Watts. I done heard the call of my friend Stan Hansen. I heard it way over here in Texas. Yeah, that's right. You're a little bit jealous of my friend now that he's got the North American Heavyweight Championship belt proudly around his waist. You're just a little jealous. You can't wait to get a chance at him. Well, let me tell you something. My man Stan Hansen is a gentleman. He is a man of integrity and honesty. And the way I hear it, he wants nothing to do with filth like you. So he's bringing in yours truly. Just take you right out of the picture. That's right, me. I'm coming in to make sure that you spend the most of your time in that ring on your back. And then my good friend, the gentleman, that handsome blonde from Borger, Texas, won't have to worry about associating with filth, people like you who don't ever deserve to wear a championship belt in professional wrestling. I want to tell you something. If you think this relationship between me and Stan Hansen ain't strong, you ain't smartened up not one little bit since I used to smack you around all over Louisiana and Oklahoma. I promise you one thing. I won't disappoint my man Stan Hansen. Get ready, Bill Watts, to dust your butt off in that ring.
Well, we all know the reputation of Cowboy Bill Watts. He's one of the great wrestlers in professional wrestling. So's Bruiser Brody. It's got to be a titanic struggle. I'd like to see it myself. You be there.
Welcome, everyone, to a very special edition of Review Away. It is John Pollock.
It is wayless.
It is wayless.
It was a wayless Review Away.
But it is mouthful, because we are joined by...
It's a big mouthful.
Dan Lavransky here in studio, and I'm trying to remember if you and I have ever done Review Away together. I don't know if we have. I know you and Way have done it.
Yeah, Way and I have done a couple, and I've done Review a Raw with you and with Jimmy Corderas. But yeah, you're right. I don't think we've done one of these together.
So this should be a lot of fun.
It's a first, ladies and gentlemen.
First time ever. Much like Raw being live on Christmas Day and New Year's Day.
That is very bizarre, eh?
First time
that,
ever.
That is really strange. I kind of feel for some of those wrestlers now. They got to do a show on Christmas Day.
And probably fly out Christmas Eve, which is just tons of fun.
And you know what? The show is probably going to be packed with a lot of really silly skits and a lot of... You know what I mean? Like, it's not even going to be a show that means anything.
Maybe it'll be the return of the big shows, the New Year's baby.
Yes, I remember
a
that.
A horrendous image.
Yeah.
But today, we are not chatting about the New Year's baby, the furthest thing from it. We are chatting about the life and career of Frank Goodish, Bruiser Brody. This was a documentary I had wanted to watch for some time, and I thought, there's no better person to do this review, obviously, than yourself, Mouth. So when Way was... going on this a work trip this week, I thought this was the perfect opportunity for us to sit down and watch this. And later in the show, to close it out, we're going to air an audio documentary that you and I put together. It was back in 2008.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Where I think we worked on it. Like, we must have done...
We worked on it for quite a few
20
months.
20 interviews or so. Like, it was a long process of trying to speak to all the key principals involved, including Barbara Goodish, about the life of Bruiser Brody. And we're going to play that at the end of the show for those that maybe have not heard
Perfect.
It.
Yeah, sounds good.
And I was able to find it, Mouth. The digital version?
Well, that's me, right? It's funny because I couldn't find the actual edit that we did of the final product, but I found the disc with all the interviews.
Oh, really?
The disc with all the guys that we interviewed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like you said, there's at least 20 different interviews on there of different guys.
Oh, yeah.
Because we had a few things, because I'd been always asking about them through the years. But then, yeah, we specifically searched people out. And thankfully, you know, people like Larry Matisick and, yeah, Barbara Goodish and that. So
yeah, we spoke with Dave Meltzer, superstar Billy Graham. And
yeah, there's a few people in ours that aren't in this one.
Yeah.
Like, I believe we had Nick Bockwinkel. I was very surprised Nick Bockwinkel wasn't in this one that High Spots did. There's a few in ours that weren't in this one.
Yeah, and we'll chat about that as well, because one notable difference was we spoke at length with Dusty Rhodes about him and Terry Funk, who was interviewed in this, but it was so brief, and I was surprised. Like, a lot of these, I mean, High Spots is the ones that produced this. Michael Elliott was the director of the documentary, and a lot of it, I mean, High Spots does a lot of these sit-down interviews, yes. And I'm sure it's going into their archives a lot that perhaps this specific Terry Funk interview didn't delve a whole lot into Brody, but he was certainly a key person attached to Brody in his history.
Yeah, oh, definitely. One of the first guys there at West Texas State that kind of got him started on the path.
I guess, first of all, Mouth, looking at this particular documentary and just the structure of it as well, certainly the big portion is the death in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
But what did you think just about the overall layout, the style of the documentary? And certainly this is a different feel than, say, a slick produced WWE version.
Of course.
But in terms of the content as well, just your overall impressions.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, High Spots is a small company. It's always been a small company. They don't have a lot of money. You know, it's a good thing that Jay is probably not reviewing this with us, because I'm sure there would have been tons of technical issues in it that Jay wouldn't have dug, because like John said, they took stuff from their archives. So here's Bobby Heenan from 2002. Well, that audio doesn't match the audio from Dave Meltzer from last year. And here's Buddy Landell from 2009, and that doesn't match. So there was technical problems with it. They don't have the money that someone like the WWE has to do a super high glossy thing. But overall, I thought it was really good. You know, the one thing I really loved, I thought really took it out of the realm of a regular one, was having Barbara narrate.
Yeah.
I thought that was just fantastic. And I thought it really, it made it so much more heartfelt than just this generic, oh, here's another documentary about a guy that died too young and he was a rebel. And I just really thought hearing her voice really added an extra layer to it that you might not get if it had just been a standard male voice.
Yeah, and she was not just a narrator. She was also obviously one of the interview subjects as well. And when you think about it, I mean, on the one hand, it was jarring at times going from the narration to hearing her, but also, I don't know how you could have seamlessly used another narrator, just an anonymous voice mm-hmm. that I think wouldn't have had the same connection
that
Barbara provided.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. I thought that was really smart part on High Spot's part to do that, because it just added a whole different layer to it, to hear her talk about him and to hear her voice describe his career rather than, you know, just some James Earl Jones style narration, you know.
I think the first person we see on this is your good pal, Killer Tim Brooks.
He was. Tim Brooks did open it. You're right. Yes, he did. Yeah. Looking good. Because the Tim Brooks interviews were new. They were not from the archive. So he looked great.
Yeah. And it might not have been recognizable to your mouth without a newspaper.
Oh, man. Have we told that? Should I tell the story?
Go ahead.
This is really funny. When John and I went to Cauliflower Alley, geez, that would be like, what, 10?
This is 2006, so
okay, 2006,
11 years
so, yeah,
ago.
John and I went, and we went down to do a bunch of interviews for the Fight Network, and we both wanted to go. I'd never been. He had never been. And one of the people that I hit up a great relationship was with Gary Hart, and him and Tim Brooks were great friends, and they were hanging out a lot together during the convention. And so one afternoon, I think it was, I was talking with Gary Hart, and we went back to his hotel room just to kind of relax and chill and have a beer and that and talk. And we open up the door, and there's Killer Tim Brooks buck naked on the bed with just reading the newspaper, just lying on the bed buck naked reading the newspaper. And he didn't even really bat an eye or get up to try to change or anything. Like, nope. Okay, hi, how's it going? He was quite the character. He told some great stories too.
Yeah, that trip, certainly Gary Hart was just, it was great to spend as much time as we got to it with Gary Hart. And conversely, your interactions with Dewey Robertson.
Oh, jeez.
Which were just the best. It capped off with Mouth doing a very good interview with him, and at the end, Missing Link telling him that he should have worn a tie.
He was upset that I didn't wear a tie during his interview. But that just to show you how great Gary Hart was, not only in telling us stories and just being super nice to us, we were trying to interview Sir Oliver Humperdinck, who was there.
That's right.
And Gary Hart went to bat for us. Humperdinck kept blowing us off. And it was Gary Hart who actually said, hey, these guys are legit. This guy knows his history. He knows what he's talking about. You should do the interview. And he sat down with us because of Gary Hart.
Gary Hart was the key to getting a number of guys kind of on board. Because you have to imagine, especially with wrestlers from that generation, even in 2006, I mean, they're very guarded and not necessarily knowing what's the angle that these guys are coming at.
And this was more when, I mean, it was open to fans at that point, but not as much as it is now. It was still more of a guarded thing when we were there as well. So yeah, a couple of them. And then there was the ones that, of course, they don't do anything unless you put some money in their hand.
And the story we had heard was like Dewey Robertson, there were just so many stories that week, but one of them was him allegedly going up to one Killer Tim Brooks and telling him to, I guess, watch his weight.
Yes!
And Brooks responding, how about you shut the fuck up?
Yeah.
Something to that effect.
It was. It was just plain and simple. Yeah, no, it was funny. And, you know, bringing him up with Gary Hart, because Gary Hart had to deal with him in Texas, with Dewey Robertson in Texas, and they did not get along, and there were some nasty incidents, and yeah, it was pretty funny.
And we had some Gary Hart in this documentary as well.
Yep. Yeah, from their archives again, yeah.
So I maybe the most random person that was featured in this very momentarily was Slick.
Yeah, totally caught me off guard.
I laughed out loud.
I did too.
Just awaiting when you would get to that part and hear Slick talking about Bruiser Brody.
I did. I was. He was not someone I expected. I kept waiting for guys like Nick Bockwinkel and stuff like that. There was a few of them even Dusty. Although I guess maybe even in their archives they didn't have anything with Dusty. But yeah, Slick was definitely a surprise. Put on a bit of weight, but still looking pretty good. He had the nice suit on and the hat and everything.
Yeah. Don't mention anything about his weight. He might Killer Tim Brooks' response have that one ready. In terms of just looking at some of the interview subjects, I think certainly Tony Atlas was one of, if not the best.
He was kind of the star of the documentary because this, I don't know, to me anyways, this is the first time I've really heard him sit down and go into intricate detail. Like, he really went into detail and the whole explanation and what he saw in the shower and, you know, holding Brody up and his intestine coming out and all that kind of stuff. It was really quite a graphic depiction of what happened in that shower stall in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, he did a book a number of years back with Scott Teal that I haven't read. And apparently, I mean, it was similar in terms of him going into detail with it. But yeah, there were a lot of details that I was not aware of.
Me too.
I'm hearing from Tony Atlas to the point that, I mean, he was essential to me.
Yes.
Of the only guy that had as close to a firsthand account of what happened in Puerto Rico. And we'll get to that
The other surprise one for me is because I haven't seen him in forever was Al Perez.
Yeah.
I did. I mean, I know he was in Texas at that time when Brody was there, so he would have had experience with him. But I was very surprised to see Al Perez. I haven't heard his name in so long. And so it was kind of neat to see him in there as well.
Yeah, and it looked like a new interview done specifically for this documentary with Larry Matizek.
Who
has been in rough health over the last number of years.
Yeah,
so.
There was definitely a few that were done specifically. I think the Al Perez one, I think, was done specifically. Larry Matizek, Aubrey the Barber Goodish was. The Tony Atlas was new, I believe.
Yeah.
I don't think that was from the archives. But they made good use of their archives. You can understand when someone like High Spots that's done so many of these sit-down interviews, you know, of course you're going to make use of stuff from your archives.
Yeah, and as well, having Barbara involved in the project as well, you got a lot of cool family photos involving him, which I always...
Oh, yeah, there was one from Christmas morning.
Yes, yes.
Christmas morning, he's opening presents with his son, and his forehead's just ripped to shreds and stuff, and it's like, wow, there's Bruiser Brody the dad.
I mean, Brody to me was always one of the best most, I don't want to say photogenic in the pretty sense, but just his image yes. just lent so well to magazine covers and just great shots.
Yep.
And they're all throughout the documentary here. If you ever picked up the hardcover version of Dave Meltzer's tribute books, there were some phenomenal yeah. photos that they found in there of Brody, and it's just there's so many great photos of him that have been captured that they
well,
got
that
in
was,
here.
That was one of the ways that I got into him when I was younger, John, was because you didn't really see him wrestle up here that much on TV until he did some stuff in Quebec for international wrestling for Gino Brito, but the magazines. Like when that was how I got him and Abdullah when I was young. They're you know, whenever they would have a match, the magazines were all over that, and they would always have them on the cover, and they'd have a big spread inside with all kinds of pictures. So, yeah, absolutely. He was someone that, you know, got your attention when you saw him on a magazine cover.
So if your introduction to him was the magazines, was Montreal where you first got to see him
yeah,
wrestle?
Yeah, because that's the thing. At that point in time, he was – those guys weren't – they weren't around up here. I mean, he never wrestled. He just did that short run for Vince that they talk about there. In the mm-hmm. 70s working with Bruno, and that was it, and it was hard to see, and this is back, there's no tape trading, there's no internet, there's none of that stuff, so yeah, international wrestling from Montreal in the early 80s, they rekindled the Brody Abdullah feud there again, and that was, I think, the first time I actually got to see him in matches.
Yeah, when they're talking about his upbringing, he was born in 46, and they mentioned the fact that he had his father was a coal miner, and then he had as well an older sister and two younger ones, which I would imagine are all still alive and would have been really interesting to
yeah.
hear from. Like you know about Barbara Goodish, but you don't really hear about, you know, Brody's sisters
right.
or ever over all these years ever speaking about their brother.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I don't know if they don't want to talk about it or maybe they're no one. I mean, you'd think Barbara would know where they are, though, and stuff like that.
It would have been a fascinating just to hear about the childhood and him growing up.
Yes.
And
what
that,
was he
that
like?
Element that Barbara
yes.
can't necessarily
yeah.
wasn't there for.
That's right. Yeah.
So then, you know, we go through just his athletic career, getting kicked out of Iowa State University, allegedly going to West Texas State, where all the wrestlers came out of, even though there's no documented history of Frank Goodish attending this university. They all swear he was there. Whether he was enrolled or not, I guess, is another question. And then it's believed to be an incident where one night he cut down this tree that had some
right.
significance and was thrown out of West Texas State.
Yeah, I think it was something to do with the president of the university, that maybe it might have been on his property or something like that, or a major, or it was a tree that had been was very old or something like that. And it definitely was enough to get him kicked out, though. Yeah,
and then he continued. He played football for the San Diego Toros. He also spent some time with the Edmonton Eskimos in the CFL, and also as a sports writer for a newspaper
yep.
out of San Antonio. And that
was amazing, seeing those pictures of him sitting with a shirt and tie, his hair short, sitting at a typewriter.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's not a throwaway comment because or fact about Brody, because I mean, Dave Meltzer has spoken about the fact that when he was first getting into the industry, he cites Larry Mazzik, Bill Watts, and Bruiser Brody as three guys that immediately understood what he was doing,
yeah.
having actual journalism covering
yeah.
pro wrestling. And I think it was because of Brody's own background that he understood that this is an industry that is absolutely should be covered like any other
yeah.
entity, and kind of they didn't brush off the Dave Meltzers of the world. They rather wanted to bring them in and educate them on the
yeah.
industry.
I also think it helped with his career, just for his perspective on professional wrestling itself, coming from a sports writer background like that, because he just took everything so seriously, and he, you know, he was very strong about how he was portrayed and all that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of that probably comes from his sports writer background as well, understanding the concept of sports and how you make yourself marketable and how you keep yourself marketable. Because that was the big thing with Brody, is that he created this image and he protected that image so strongly that, you know, a lot of guys thought he was real. He was legit. I mean, he was one of those guys where you'd watch and you'd kind of question. You'd actually go, okay, this guy looks pretty intense. He looks like he's hitting those guys pretty hard. And I think the sports writer background definitely helped with that.
And then kind of his entry into wrestling came through Ivan Putski, who he met at the San Antonio Health Club. And then we go through kind of his start in Texas, working with Joe Blanchard, with Fritz Von Erich, which ended up getting him booked in All Japan. And then going through, he worked in Florida. I mean, he worked in a number of different places. And then All Japan kind of being his big launching pad in Japan, which ended up where he would jump to New Japan for a much bigger offer later. And that's kind of outlined as well, how big of a war it was between All Japan and New Japan at the time.
That's it, right? It was huge at the time, very similar to the WWF-WCW war that we saw there in the late 90s. But yeah, the two promotions were on fire. And, you know, big foreign talent like him and Stan Hansen, those guys were gold for Japan because they were completely different. They had a completely different look. And they knew what to do to get excitement and to get reactions out of the people. The thing I always loved about Brody and Hansen when they went to Japan is that they knew exactly what to do to get maximum reaction out of the people in the audience.
Yeah, and I mean, Brody in Japan always linked to Stan Hansen. I mean, they were originally paired together and then split up by Bill Watts in the U.S.
Right.
But it was both guys who were – they made their fame and fortune primarily in Japan,
yep.
And then it was Brody leaving for New Japan where he got an incredible offer where it's outlined in the documentary. He was getting $14,000 a week,
yeah.
And that was going to escalate each year. But he didn't last in New Japan very long because he was not happy with the way it was organized.
No, that's the thing. He didn't get along well with Inoki, and the matches with Inoki were not that great because they were both kind of scared. They were both kind of worried, as they talk about in the documentary. Well, can Inoki win? Well, then he's going to want the win back. Well, can Brody win? Well, we can't have that because he'll want the win back. Like, they're so... You know, that was the era, too, when winners and losers meant something. It's not like today where it doesn't really mean anything. So they were very protective. So the two of them kind of butted heads because they were both so headstrong. And, yeah, stuff like the way the tours were ran, just the way the wrestlers were treated. He didn't think New Japan did it right. Whereas Baba ran a really tight ship and took care of everybody, and things were done the right way.
Now, were you in this 80s period, was that before you were really following the Japanese scene?
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah. Because, again, it wasn't until tape trading really it was until probably early to mid-90s when I was able to get tapes on a regular basis.
Yeah, so just looking at the Japan side of things, after he left New Japan – it took him a while to kind of go back to All Japan where, I mean, the doors were not necessarily open for him. And then he eventually was brought back for Baba did bring him back because of the business reasons. But they outline here the fact that, you know, Brody, it was very rare this guy lost. Mm-hmm. And he put over Jumbo Tsuruta and kind of had to earn his way back into All Japan. And that shows you where Brody and kind of his thinking was that, because of all the issues he had with New Japan, leaving what was a gigantic figure, and it was only going to escalate with the future years on that contract with New Japan and going back to All Japan for what was a lesser deal and would be with All Japan right until his end.
Yeah, no, it's definitely – he took things seriously, and if it wasn't done the way he liked it, then he was out of there.
And, I mean, we got some of this in the documentary. Certainly whenever there's a figure that – dies, especially tragically, you're going to get a lot of people remembering the positive sides of Brody. But there were a lot of people, and I think this came out more in the people we spoke to, some of who viewed him very negatively, and Bobby Heenan was one of them.
And I found it very funny watching Heenan in the high spots thing because he pretty well said exactly the same things to us.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, Heenan did not waver. Heenan was not a fan. Nick Bockwinkel was not a big fan of Brody. And essentially, you'll hear this in our documentary at the end of the show, was that, you know, he kind of called Jose Gonzalez's bluff and he got stabbed.
Yeah.
Like that was – Bockwinkel pretty much put the onus on Brody for the way he conducted business.
Yeah, apparently – him and Jose Gonzalez had issues long before this, and apparently he would get on Jose and bug him and harass him and stuff like that. And I guess it just kind of built up, part of that built up over the years. And then when there was the issue this particular night, I guess that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. But absolutely, do not think that Brody was not somewhat responsible for the things that happened to him. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I found it really interesting in the documentary when Barbara talked about how she thought, because a lot of people just thought he was out for himself, and she put across the idea, well, no, he wanted things to be good so everybody on the card would profit. And I think that's just, you know, and I'm not sure if I even really buy that or not, but I just found that a fantastic dynamic that she's kind of putting it across like he wanted the best for everyone, and everybody else is kind of like, well, no, he was just kind of out for himself. The different perspectives I found was fascinating.
Well, it was also an industry that it didn't really promote camaraderie and,
right.
and unity when it came to standing up to promoters. I mean, it was very much a selfish industry in that sense, because you weren't going to be taken care of when you move on to another territory or had to retire and could no longer work in the industry. So a lot of these guys were simply looking at it as protecting their character, because there was no value to hurting yourself in a territory that's going to damage you in the eyes of other mm-hmm. promoters.
Yeah.
And throughout all of this, throughout all of his U.S. work, was the fact that his ultimate fortune was in Japan, where losing was not an option mm-hmm. when you were working for Baba or Inoki. And I think this was a guy who was very aggressive in terms of what he felt was his leverage and playing that. And that was kind of the balancing act of how far you push with some promoters before you got either guys that didn't want to do business with you or ones that in an extreme case were going to be violent mm-hmm. with you.
Well, that's the whole dynamic of his career, you know. When he was in Japan and he was with Baba, Baba treated him so great, paid him well, took care of him, that, you know, he totally respected Baba. But then you might get a promoter here in North America and he promises him so much money, or he says, oh, the house was down tonight. And Brody, you know, Matisic makes it clear that Brody had a great eye for judging the size of a house and figuring out how many people were there on a night. And he knew if promoters were going to were messing with him. And I find it fascinating that he would take it out there. Like, he would, like, you know, he would, like, the, you know, the match with Luger or some of these stories that we
hear. Which have all the footage of the Luger yeah. cage match.
Yeah, some of these stories we hear about him going out there and not selling for guys, or just sitting down in the middle of the ring and doing nothing, or making sure he walked out in the crowd before the show so that everybody could see that he was there and then not show up for the main event and stuff like that. Like, he used some really drastic tactics to get his point across, but that was the thing. If, like Larry Matisic says in it, if you were his friend and you treated him right, he was there for you. But if you screwed him, and just screwed him once, that was it. You're on the enemies list.
Yeah, and the Luger stuff was interesting to watch. I mean, kind of the justification that they explain was the fact that Luger, who was this upstart in Florida, he was about to jump to Jim Crockett Promotions at the time, and Brody was just not going to do business with him. And the story Luger tells is that when he got to the back with Brody, Brody like had no issue with him. And then that was somewhat contradicted.
It was.
That Luger just yeah. hightailed it afterwards.
Yeah, there was a couple people that said Luger never talked to him, that he just got the hell out of there, which is what it looks. I mean, he, certainly watching the footage, it was great to see the footage if you've never seen it before, because Brody's just standing there and Luger's trying to lay in shots. And Bill Alfonso was the referee in that match.
Which I never realized,
yeah.
actually, until it was, you know, outlined with Luger trying to communicate with Alfonso during the match, because you're watching the footage and it greatly enhanced the story to have the footage mm-hmm. there of Brody just not selling a thing for yeah. Luger, and Luger having no idea what to do. And it ends with Fonzie having to just call for the DQ in
yes.
the cage match.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
Some other notes here that we can go through. I mean, there was some brief stuff about his teaming with Jimmy Snuka as well during their time in All Japan together. And then later the jump with Hansen showing up and delivering the lariat attack as well during the Real World Tag Finals with Brody and Snuka against the Funks, and then forming the team with Brody and
yeah.
Hansen, which was red hot at that time
yeah.
and believed to be the big match All Japan was building to at the time of his death, which certainly would have been a huge deal in All Japan.
Yeah, watching any time you talk about Brody, the what if question always comes up huge, right? Yeah, he would have had that. Him and Hansen would have tore the place down in singles matches with each other. They probably would have been off the charts. But yeah, there's so many questions, because 1988, such, you know, a really pivotal time in pro wrestling where, You know, we've just had the expansion by McMahon. It's still in its early stages. Wrestling's very, very hot in 1988. It's just, you know, like they talk about the idea of him coming to the WWF and doing a program with Hogan. It would have been huge. It would have been huge if it had ever happened. So it's really unfortunate that his life ends when it does, because he might have even went on to even a bigger, like, he might have even been a bigger name than he is now if he had, lived.
Yeah, he was 41, 42 at the time of his death.
Yeah, he was early 40s, yeah.
So, I mean, when you think about things, I mean, where do you see that career? Because by the time you're 41, 42, I mean, you're probably looking at that final kind of run, if you're going to have one with the WWF, a ton of travel, but also less demands than for instance, an All Japan kind of schedule and that kind of work style. Do you envision that would have been where he would have gone shortly afterwards at that point?
I think it would have been inevitable. I mean, he had been there before. I mean, it's Vince Sr. that gave him the name Brody. So, I mean, I think that Vince Jr. would have brought him back. I think it would have been impossible to ignore, because he was such a presence. That's what Vince liked. Vince would take, you know, these big guys and bring them in against Hogan. Your Kamalas, your Sikas, and all that kind of stuff. And I think
Brody was a natural opponent for Hogan. It totally fit the formula of what they wanted, of the big monster coming in.
He would be able to cut promos. I think WWF fans would have been really freaked out by seeing someone like Brody. Oh, I'm sure he would have done major with Vince. Now, the thing is, though, because the typical plan usually, or what they would do, is that the big monster heel would come in, he'd challenge Hogan, he'd have a big match with Hogan, or they'd do a series of house show matches or a pay-per-view, and that was it. Then the guy would start to fall down the card. And I just have to wonder how Brody...
Knowing that, Brody would have totally known the formula.
Yeah.
And much like Piper, who that was always his card he was never going to play, was that loss to Hogan.
Yeah.
You're sacrificing yourself. Would Brody have at the end done the big match with Hogan?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Exactly. I don't know if he would have ever taken that final big pinfall, because that means you're kind of off the map after that. So that's a very interesting issue. But I mean,
because you look as well at that time, like 1988, at the time of his death, that's when Savage is champion. Hogan is still like in the midst of everything. Yeah. That had Brody come within that year, he very well could have catapulted past Ultimate Warrior at that time and become the prime.
Imagine that if
opponent.
WrestleMania 6 had been Brody versus Hogan instead of the Ultimate Warrior.
I think if Brody was willing to do business and lose to Hogan at that show, I think there's a very good chance he could have been in that position.
And you know what? By that point, he might have done it, because it's very clear. Barbara makes it very clear in the documentary that he was really well aware of, he only has so much time. He knew, like, unlike these guys that just don't seem to realize it, he knew his body was going to break down. He knew he was getting close to that point where he wouldn't be able to work as hard as he did in the past. And I think, you know, if something like WrestleMania 6, the scope and the scope of that was so big that if he would have got that super huge big payday, he might have done it. You know, he might have done it if he could make the money, which he felt was sufficient, and if he felt, well, you know what, I am getting close to the end of my career.
Because as well, if you had brought him in as the monster heel for Hogan, I think the card you play with Brody is the fact that you lose to Hogan and then you get the babyface run out of it. Because I think if you made him this unstoppable monster, it would be a very easy switch to make him a big babyface character afterwards,
right?
And could work with heels for the next year.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I find interesting is if Paul Heyman had got his hands on someone like Bruiser Brody in the early days of ECW, because Brody's one of the fathers of that kind of crazy brawling style, and I just wonder what would happen if someone like Heyman, even just off the start, was able to use someone like Bruiser Brody, or if the two of them, I don't know if the two of them maybe would have butted heads, but that's another thing I think of it about, just because he would have fit so well into that ECW kind of mold, you know?
Well, and today, I mean, the only person in, at least in North America, that you could make the comparison to would be a Brock Lesnar to that kind of style, of a guy who felt real and had that unique kind of persona that separated himself from everyone else. It would have been interesting, certainly, as a guy that saw his body definitely not breaking down, but certainly he was seeing his limitations by the end.
Yeah.
Would he have been able to last until the big Monday Night War period where, you know, he would have been about 50 at that point, mm-hmm. that a WCW would have brought in, that an ECW would – I think Paul would have certainly wanted to bring him in even if he was extremely limited at that point and couldn't do all the things he could have 15 years earlier.
Yeah, and the thing is, Brody was – he was smart in terms of working in that, and he did – he was one of those guys that took really good care of himself. Like, I mean, really good care of himself, and knew what to eat, knew how to work without over, you know, building himself up. And I think even at 50, he probably would have been able to be a pretty imposing figure and definitely would have been able to make a mark. It's just, would he have played along with what they wanted? That's always the eternal question.
One thing that certainly Barbara talks about, but even more so all of his colleagues, I mean, the majority that it's brought up with, is the fact of his, like, they talk about how much he cared about being at home with his family, his son. There's even the story with Tony Atlas that right the night of his death, he wanted to have this picture because Tony Atlas did a lot of artwork.
Yeah.
And that really comes through that Brody was not, he was not shy about sharing with other wrestlers, you know, his love for his son, for his family. Like, this was a guy that maybe professionally people could disagree with, but seemed to be a guy that did have his priorities in order.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's all it was why he did what he did, was to support his family. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised he would have had more children as well. Like, it strikes me that I'm sure him and Barbara would have had more kids. You know, he would have probably had a bigger family. Yeah.
And Barbara outlines, like, when she would be driving him to the airport, the transformation he would go through.
That was a great story.
Where as they're getting closer to the airport, I mean, once he got out of that car, he wasn't Frank Goodish any longer. And from that airport up until he would come home, he had the Bruiser Brody button on.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting to hear from Barbara, who's not a wrestling person, just outline this transformation. And I mean, some of her stories just about how the two met in Australia.
As
she was a hotel clerk and Brody invited her out with all the wrestlers and then had them all leave. So it's just the two
clever.
Of them left.
Yeah, pretty clever.
I mean, Barbara added a lot of interesting context to who this guy was beyond the character.
That's it. And she's really the only one that can give that, because all the guys that worked with him, I mean, sure, guys like Matisic and Meltzer became good friends with him and confidants. But that's it. These guys just see him in his Bruiser Brody mode, and she saw him as Frank. And that story, especially the one about the airport, where he would just stand up straight, walk through those airport doors, and that's it, man. He's Bruiser Brody now.
And then Larry Matisic also talked about when he had broken away from the NWA and was starting to run shows by himself, and he would utilize Brody on these shows. And Brody was very much going around working the independents, and it's an interesting comparison to the current scene we have, where you're starting to see a number of guys that are difference makers on the independents. Your Young Bucks, Kenny Omega, Cody Rhodes, guys that are finding that there's life outside of the WWE. Mm-hmm. At that time, Brody was the guy that he was making a living for himself without a major North American home in WCW, NWA at the time, the WWF. He had his Japanese income, but in the States, he was able to just go to the highest bidder and was someone that his drawing ability, that was his currency that he was able to deal in with promoters.
Yeah, that's the thing. For a small promoter, if you wanted to draw people to a show, and you could, you know, even if Brody was your only big star on the show and the rest was all local guys, you could get attention from him. And it is a fascinating model that it's taken a while to be able to work. It's because it needed almost the era that we're in now with social media and the internet and so many 5,000 cable channels, that all these smaller promotions and guys can go to so many different places now. Back then, in Brody's time, you know, they might have had little localized television, but now, because of the internet, you put your show on YouTube, the whole world can see it.
I wouldn't want to have seen Bruiser Brody on Twitter.
No?
No. I don't think Bruiser Brody and that character should have ever been on Twitter. Maybe Instagram, because he did have great photos.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't know if Bruiser Brody was meant for Twitter. This was when they went over kind of his exit from All Japan, going to New Japan for the money that he was – he was going from $10,000 a week in All Japan to $14,000 a week in New Japan. And they also mentioned the fact that All Japan was starting to utilize the Road Warriors as well, who certainly – I mean, they were very much in the – kind of the same kind of makeup as a Bruiser Brody.
Big brawler type dudes, yeah.
And Brody was kind of sensing the tide and if it was changing and thus moved to New Japan and quickly regretted it afterwards. And it was while he was in between leaving New Japan and his return to All Japan that Puerto Rico opened up as an opportunity, and that was his entry into the World Wrestling Council. And that takes us into Puerto Rico, and kind of the last half hour of the documentary is dedicated to the death and hearing from many different people. Including the most awkward
Carlos Colon.
Carlos Colon.
Carlos Colon, man. He came – yeah, he just looked terrible. He came off so bad in this.
But you know what? In his like bumbling around with an answer, it spoke volumes.
Yeah, well, that's it.
Uncomfortable topic it is for this guy.
Yeah, he came across as totally insincere. I didn't trust anything that he said. I thought he was lying. Well, everything he said was contradicted by everybody that was there, everybody else that they interviewed. So, I mean, Carlos, I think, was just trying to protect himself and his business, but it came off, didn't make him look good, that's for sure.
So, I thought the key people, we mentioned Tony Atlas, Dutch Mantel also added quite a lot to this as well. He wasn't in the locker room as
he was there that night.
He was there that night because you had the heel and the babyface dressing rooms on the opposite ends at Juan Lubriel Stadium in Bayamon. And they talked about the fact that it was Gonzalez that was supposed to be driving Brody to the stadium. And he ended up grabbing a ride. I guess it was with Buddy Landell and somebody else he got to the stadium with, and that's when we kind of get the whole play-by-play of what happened through Tony Atlas with Gonzalez coming in. He had a towel on his hand and they went into the showers, and that's when you heard this gigantic scream from Brody and Atlas coming in to see he had been stabbed 2 to 3 times, and you know his intestine is coming out.
Oh.
And it's really sad that you hear this situation that as bad as it was, the scene, it was compounded by the fact that it took 45 minutes to an hour to get an ambulance there. The local radio station had to call for an ambulance on the air. And it was just – that to me is one of the more tragic elements to all this, is that he could have been saved, it sounded like.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. If this had happened in North America, he probably would have been saved, right? It was just the inadequacy of the facilities that were down there. And they didn't even – apparently, they didn't take him to the closest hospital. They took him to a hospital that was farther away, so that compounded issues, and they just didn't really have the stuff at hand that they needed to help him. It's really tragic. Yeah.
Yeah. Tony Atlas was saying how Colon was stopping him from going after Jose Gonzalez, and it felt like Atlas really conveys a scene of almost indifference that some of the wrestlers had to this, like almost like their own paranoia of the industry believed that this was some kind of an angle, or they just were just – they didn't want to admit what they had seen, or at least they didn't want to implicate Jose Gonzalez. That kind of is the tone you get, that these guys, when the authorities came, they're all looking down. There was a story that he had banged his head on a sink, that a fan stabbed him.
Yeah,
it was like
fan.
All these stories, and Atlas felt like he was the only one here who realized what had happened.
Yeah, I don't know if it was that they were that – insecure about staying with the promotion, or they felt that they couldn't say anything because it was Puerto Rico and it's like the wild, wild west, which several of them say in the documentary, or what it was. But it's true. The way that the rest of the locker room handled it was not good at all. And it's kind of scary, actually, that they wouldn't put up more of a fight. And some of them went back. That's the thing that surprised me, that some of them went back after this. I mean, why would you ever go back?
Yeah, you had Atlas who like the wrestlers wouldn't even help Brody into the ambulance. So Atlas describes that he had to just deadlift him and carry him into the ambulance.
Yes. And think of that. Think of Brody as dead weight.
Yeah.
That's a lot. It would be heavy, heavy, heavy as hell.
And yeah, you certainly get that Tony Atlas, that like this was a night that totally soured this guy, I think, on his industry.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if everything he says is accurate, completely justifiable based on, you know, this guy who had just been privy to this scene in front of him, and it just seemed everyone else, they went ahead, the show happened, Jose Gonzalez returned.
Yeah, he came back and wrestled. Match. Yeah, exactly, came back and wrestled. He's still working in Puerto Rico, isn't he?
He's 71, he's still around.
He's still involved.
The knife was never found.
Yeah.
And then they kind of go over the following. Like, Atlas gave a police statement, and then the trial occurred where a verdict was reached, and it was the day afterwards Atlas received his subpoena.
Yeah, same. Dutch said the same thing. He knew the result of the trial.
Atlas was never contacted.
Yeah.
Dutch received his subpoena the day after.
Yeah, Dutch said he had already found out what happened in the trial when he got his subpoena. And that, yeah, it's just – it's ridiculous. It also shows you the power that – probably Cologne and Gonzalez had for things to play out like this. Cause that, you know, there had to have been some tampering. I mean, sure, there was the problem of it's Puerto Rico and maybe they're not getting things done as well as they should, but there had to have been some tampering going on there for that to not reach them until after the trial.
Yeah. And I mean, at that time, I mean, were you aware of like this going on? Was this like a prominent story that you were aware of in 1988?
Yeah. Or? Yeah. Yeah. It was.
I was four and I was not aware of it.
I'm pretty sure, John, that some of the magazines covered it.
Yeah.
The magazines covered it, but they didn't go into details and stuff like that.
Which is kind of an interesting scenario for like your aftermags to be looking at
magazines.
A very real story in their context at that in 1988.
Yeah. No, I do remember hearing about it. I don't know. It must have been on the news or maybe I read it in some of the mags. But I was very aware that after I'd seen him that was it.
Yeah. And I mean, they turned Jose Gonzalez babyface on TV at the time. And he was – they didn't rule that he was – not guilty, but it was that it was done in self-defense.
Yeah, that was the plea, self-defense. Then they managed to hold this trial, and it's unbelievable how it played out. It really is. It's one of the darkest spots on professional wrestling, as far as I'm concerned.
Like, it's unjustifiable that Tony Atlas was not called into
any
this
of those. Every single
trial.
Guy that was in that locker room should have been subpoenaed or be involved in that trial or gave statements or were witnesses or something. But then again, you know, some of them, the way they acted, if they'd got subpoenaed, who knows if they would have even. I mean, I think Dutch and Tony Atlas would have, but after that, who knows?
You know, I know it's been almost 30 years now since it happened, but I was still amazed at how calm Barbara Goodish is able to recount this and what had to have been the worst night of her life, receiving this phone call saying there had been an accident. You should get down to Puerto Rico. And here you are with a young child in a foreign country.
And
here is the end result that your husband and father of your child is dead.
Yeah.
And she was told this news as Abdullah the Butcher is in the
airport.
Scrambling to get out of the country.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what that woman went through at that time period.
It's true. She does hold it together very well. I mean, even when we interviewed her, John, I thought, wow, such decorum and strength from this woman. Yeah, she's totally a unique lady. That is for sure. I can definitely see why he was attracted to her, because she comes across as a very strong, strong woman. You know, like, that's the thing. There's no footage where you might break down a little bit while you're recounting the story. Lots of people, I think, you know, in this kind of situation, they would break into tears. And nope, she, unbelievable.
Yes. So Atlas, Jay and Mark Youngblood as well, never contacted for the trial. And Carlos Colon added a comment that he didn't see a stabbing or a weapon.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, it ended here with Barbara kind of talking about where Brody's career may have gone, and everyone seemed to conclude that it was a natural. He'd work with Hogan, citing the history with Vince Sr., and even Larry Matizek talking about they had discussed maybe opening up a sports agency, him running a camp for disadvantaged youth, and certainly this was a very ambitious individual who had a lot of plans beyond pro wrestling, and you could sense at this time he was already looking at that avenue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, a really smart guy, like really ahead of his time in terms of planning for his future, because that back in that era, none of those guys planned for the future, none of them. They just lived day to day, and, you know, that was it, and once it was over, it was over, and some of them, you know, were able to keep going and do other things. You know, J.J. Dillon was a prison guard and stuff like that. But A lot of the other ones, you know, they still have to do indie shows today. Greg Valentine, you still see at indie shows because he just never took care of himself. He never put any money aside. And Brody understood that. He understood it right from the very beginning that I can't do this forever. I can't live this lifestyle forever. I need to plan for my future. Like, it's amazing. You know, this just makes me wish I could have sat down with the guy and talked to the guy, because it would have been absolutely fascinating, because he obviously was a really smart, as the Japanese said, the intelligent monster. He was really, really smart, clever guy.
Yeah, and I mean, going back to that newspaper background, I don't think he would have been one of those guys from that era that would have been a closed book. I think he would have been totally open and been a fascinating subject for years to come. Yep. About the industry, the history of All Japan and New Japan during that time, and him being a key piece of that that chessboard.
He could have written a pretty amazing book, you know. Him and Matisic together, I think, would have done an amazing book about
his career. He probably would have – I'm sure he would have. I mean, he did have booking jobs during his career. I'm sure that would have continued into his 50s. Like,
yeah.
I'm sure that even if his body was breaking down, I think he would have been a prominent figure if he had chosen to work behind the scenes and be in a significant creative role.
Yeah, it would have been very interesting to see him involved in a creative role, because he had great ideas. He understood how things worked. I always think of ECW. You know, if he had been around, I think Paul Heyman would have grabbed him, and he would have made really good use of him, even just to either help get guys over or to help teach guys how to work, or yeah, creatively. I'm sure there would have been some interesting things there.
I guess, what were some of your final thoughts on the documentary? What you liked, what you didn't like? Was there anything that you were left that maybe wasn't addressed, could have been done better? Just what were some of your final thoughts
overall,
on the documentary?
Overall, I thought it was good. I thought, you know, with this type of documentary, when you want to talk about someone from that era, much like the Mad Dog Vachon book that Pat LaPrade and Bertrand Herbert just finished, you gotta get a lot of people to talk about it. And I thought that was one of the strengths of this.
A lot of people.
Like Bruno Sammartino, just for that brief period where he was in the WWF and he had some matches with Bruno. There's Bruno to talk about it. And I really thought they did a great job. I mean, technical issues aside, whatever. I don't really care about that. But I do really think they did an amazing job. Like, yeah, I mean, look, you know, Bill Apter, Bob Armstrong. Like, look at all they talked to so many great people that were part of that era. Hanson. I thought Hanson's stuff was, like, absolutely amazing. Ron Bass.
Yeah.
Outlaw Ron Bass.
With, like, that mustache.
Yeah. Got to keep the mustache. But, you know, and like I said earlier, Al Perez, just finding all these guys, even if they just had a remote connection to him and interviewing. I thought that was the real standout, was the Kevin Sullivan. Like, just so.
And Slick.
Well, okay. Slick was kind of the cherry on the top. I don't know if it would have been any better or worse if Slick had not been in it, but I thought that was, to me, was what I really enjoyed. And the involvement of Barbara and the fact that she narrated it, as I said earlier, I just thought, it just takes it out of the realm of all the rest of them and just makes it something really, really different. Like, when it opens and she does a voiceover and you see her on the beach, and I thought, okay, this is kind of a cool way to open it. But then she kept doing it, and I thought, wow, this is really smart. It just separates it from every other wrestling documentary I think I've ever seen.
Yeah. You can pick up this documentary at the highspotswrestlingnetwork.com. It's, if you don't subscribe to their streaming service, it's easy to rent this. It's $5.
Yeah, it's
certainly
nothing.
Worth it.
It's totally worth it. You can rent it. You get to keep it. I think you get it for 2 or 3 days, so you can watch it more than once if you want to.
Or you can buy it outright for $10.
Yeah,
so
which is, again,
very affordable.
Not that bad at all. And if you're interested in his career, certainly, I mean, there's a couple of good books which they mentioned.
Yeah, Barbara and Larry Matisic put out one. Emerson Murray, who's
in it,
interviewed
in
this as well.
Yeah.
We had him on the show years back when he put out his book. That's very good. Certainly Dave Meltzer's writing on Meltzer, on Brody, including his obituary, is all stuff you should check out.
Yeah.
Because it's a fascinating story, and it's one that could easily be something, like, you could do, like, a massive documentary on this, like, at the, like, An HBO level, like an ESPN 30 for 30 on Bruiser Brody would be phenomenal.
I think you could make a great Hollywood film out of this, right? I mean, if you wanted to take a fascinating story about a wrestler's career, I think, you know, this would make an amazing motion picture. I think the story is fascinating.
I mean, there's even been bands named after Frank Goodish.
I remember that was one of the highlights when we did ours, and I told Barbara that I had named my band after Bruiser Brody. And
she loved it.
Yeah. She's like, Frank would have loved this. I'm like, oh, man. I almost started crying. I was like, that to me, unbelievable. That was like so great for me to hear that he would have actually got a kick out of it.
Yeah, I remember that. That was you couldn't get a better compliment.
Yeah, I was totally blown away by that. Yeah.
Well, those were our thoughts on Bruiser Brody, wrestling's last rebel. Once again, it's up at highspotswrestlingnetwork.com. We're going to end the show with the audio documentary that we have promised. This, once again, it was done in 2008 with Mouth conducting about 1,000 interviews. And we put it together. It's about 25 minutes to close out the show, hearing from many names, some of which are in this documentary.
Yeah,
some of which are unique to ours, including Hulk Hogan chatting about Bruiser Brody, geez. No less. So lots of names here. And that is it for us. Way will be back on the next review away. We don't know what we're reviewing yet. We should have a subject matter for Monday's review of Raw to announce. So Way will be back. Mouth, thank you as always.
No problem. That was great. It was good because I wanted to watch the documentary anyways, but doing something like this, you like forcing me. You're like, well, okay, if John needs me to watch it, I guess I better watch it.
I find it's always...
We're busy guys, right? We're busy guys, and it's sometimes hard when you've got 10 hours of TV, and then this past couple of weeks, we've got all the Mae Young classic shows. There's a lot to watch. And sometimes the stuff that you really want to get to gets kind of thrown to the side. So I was really happy that you asked me because then I got to actually sit down and watch it. And it's totally, if you're into wrestling history, it's a must see.
Yeah. It's one of the things I like doing this show because I do not watch any MMA or wrestling for leisure anymore. So doing this show, I like to go back and watch stuff and find a reason to do it. So it helps to have that outlet to kind of push you to check out a lot of stuff. So this was a very informative and well done documentary, but here it is. Our own audio documentary on the one Frank Goodish from 2008.
I'm 37 today, and I think that I probably got 10 more good years left in professional wrestling. Now, if I had 15 and I had 10, I'm looking at maybe 20 or 25 years in professional wrestling. I don't think there's anybody, maybe George Blanda, who can say they spend more than 20 years in NFL. So I'm very happy with the way fate has taken its course. I didn't ever guess that I was going to be a professional wrestler. Once I started in professional wrestling, learned sort of the ropes and the ins and outs, if I had it to do over again, I think that I would probably even pass up my 3 years in the NFL and devote them to wrestling because it's been that good to me.
There is no doubt that Bruiser Brody has become a legend of mythic proportions through both his wrestling career and his tragic death. What people don't seem to realize, however, is that Bruiser Brody the persona and Frank Goodish, the man who portrayed them, were two distinctly different people. Frank's wife, Barbara Goodish.
And he was this gentle giant of a man standing there, you know, in the foyer, and I checked him in, and I gave him a room that was a little better than average because he was so polite, and I knew, I mean, he just arrived, so I think it was the first time he'd been overseas, and he was totally out of his element.
Longtime friend and colleague, Dusty Rhodes.
We grew up together in the industry, and then before that in Canyon, Texas, at West Texas State, where we first met. We ran around together. I knew him. He was not an arrogant guy. He had a great heart. But he understood that there was a battle that he had to fight. He believed there was a battle that he would fight between the promoters and the way he wanted to be used.
For wrestling fans that saw him in his prime, the image of this 6'8" monster running through the crowd, swinging a chain, and bellowing "Huss!" at anyone and everyone is one they will never forget. While he had no problem having a technical match with the likes of Ric Flair, more often than not, Brody was one of the best brawling big men ever.
and judging by his scarred forehead, it was obvious he understood the phrase, turning red into green. Former manager and matchmaker, Gary Hart.
When it came to putting, you know, people in the seats and making money, he was wonderful. I never had a problem with Bruiser.
Former AWA champ, Nick Bockwinkel.
Here was a man who had tremendous talent, tremendous charisma, and just could be a main event drawing attraction in three or four weeks. He was that powerful.
Jim Harris, a.k.a. Kamala the Ugandan Giant.
He would always talk to me about how to make money and don't stay in one place and, you know, things like that. And matter of fact, he was the first one to give me my biggest payoff. He got it himself, me working against him.
Dave Meltzer, editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter.
I think he was smarter than almost, you know, I don't want to say anyone, but he was in that upper echelon of guys for sure, as far as he understood how to get over, which was one of the reasons, you know, and one of the reasons he was so valuable. You know, he definitely had an interesting mentality of, like, looking at a match and looking at spots.
Yet after every blood-soaked encounter, Brody would return to the dressing room and to the world of the man who created him, Frank Goodish. The two couldn't have been more different.
One was a role and one was himself. The role was Bruiser Brody, where he changed his character. When he was Frank Goodish, he was so different to Bruiser Brody. He was one of the few people that could leave it at the door and not try to bring the character into his personal life.
Frank Goodish was born June 18th, 1946, just outside of Pittsburgh. He was a star athlete through high school, excelling in both basketball and the sport that would take him to college, football. He started at Iowa State in 1964, but he was booted out for not attending classes. He wound up at West Texas State with a number of future players in the wrestling industry. Trouble stuck to the young Goodish as he was kicked out of West Texas State after a late-night drinking session leading to him chopping down a rare tree on campus. Former NWA champion Terry Funk.
Well, I don't know if I mentioned it, but he was an Iowa State boy. He got kicked out of Iowa State. This old Joe Kerbel gave him a scholarship down there. And I'll be darned if he didn't go ahead and get kicked out of West Texas.
Tag team partner Stan the Lariat Hansen.
Well, we met in college. We both played football at West Texas State.
Right.
You know, and Brody was, you know, he's 3 years older than me. He was there when I came as a high school recruit, and I met him, and then he was there for my freshman year, but, you know, he found an exit somehow. Anyway, he found an exit from West Texas.
Never deterred, Goodish continued his dream of playing football by trying out for the Washington Redskins in 1968 under the legendary coach Vince Lombardi. Close friend, Larry Madison.
Brody had played pro football for a year with the Washington Redskins under Vince Lombardi the year he was coaching there, although he got cancer that year, and Brody ended up being taxi-squatted. And he learned a lesson there because he often told me, he said, you know, I was as tough as all those guys, but I'd always gotten by him being tough. And I never took time to learn those fundamental things. I didn't know all that stuff.
Right.
Then I got up there, and they're just as tough as me, but they know the fundamentals, so that's where I got taken down.
After being cut before his second season with the Redskins, Goodish had a brief stint with the San Antonio Toros team. It was here that he was introduced to wrestler Ivan Putski and realized that he could have a career outside football in pro wrestling.
You never heard about unknown guys, and I remember Frank the Hammer Goodish as, I think, Southern champion or something, or Florida champion.
Goodish began under Leroy McGurk in 1975 in Louisiana, a territory he would return to years later, working under Bill Watts for the UWF. From here, he cut his teeth in the Texas promotion of Fritz Von Erich, as well as headlining in Florida for Eddie Graham as Frank the Hammer Goodish. It was his stint here that brought him to the attention of Vince McMahon Sr., who eventually called him to come to New York. McMahon Sr. was the one who gave Goodish the name Bruiser Frank Brody, who, after dropping the Frank, was forever known as Bruiser Brody. Despite this solidifying of the gimmick and the potential for a program with then WWWF champion Bruno Sammartino, Goodish's stay was short-lived after he got into a heated argument with agent Gorilla Monsoon and left the company. Superstar Billy Graham.
I was in the locker room in Philadelphia when a tremendous altercation took place between Brody and Gorilla Monsoon. It's a story that legends are made out of, and they almost came to blows, and Vince Sr., even though he was kind of frail at the time, he was trying to pull these guys apart, and they never did go, but they almost hooked up, and that would have been a dance that would have moved buildings.
It was a booking thing, I know that. I don't know what the booking thing was over, but, you know, they did, you know, in those days, Gorilla and Vince Sr. did pretty much most of the booking, especially the undercard guys. And I think he made a suggestion, and I think that it was kind of met with, you know, it's not your position to make suggestions, and then he got hot, and then they got hot.
It was also at this time that Brody met the man who would ultimately murder him in cold blood years later. Jose Gonzalez was just getting started in the business, but he and Brody did not see eye to eye from the start, and Brody wasn't afraid to rib and embarrass Gonzalez in front of the rest of the locker room. This behavior would come back to haunt him.
Way back in the mid-70s when Vince was working, or when Brody was working for Vince Sr., Jose Gonzalez was up there, the man who knifed him.
Right.
And Brody had apparently done a number on him in the ring. Gonzalez got a little feisty, and Brody supposedly broke his jaw.
Eight-time NWA champ Harley Race.
He bullied guys in the ring. He bullied them out of the ring. But if you really stood up to him and said, no, this ain't going any further, he'd back off of it.
Because Brody wasn't afraid to challenge promoters when he thought he was being cheated, many deemed him hard to work with, and many stopped using him. Former Mid-South promoter Bill Watts.
That's that character flaw that he developed, where it really was what he was turning on was he would agree to a certain amount of money to come in the gate, and then he'd go out and look at the house, and if he thought the house was better than what the money should be, then he would hijack the promoter and say, look, if you don't then give me this extra money, I'm going to walk out of here, after he'd walked around the house and let everybody know he was there.
He understood that there was a battle that he had to fight. He believed there was a battle that he would fight between the promoters and the way he wanted to be used.
If a promoter, even one time, cheated him on a payoff, lied to him about something he wanted done, well, as far as Brody was concerned, the relationship's over as far as me being honest with you. I will now go to the ends of the earth to screw you.
I never got to sit down with him and say, why do you have such a hard-on for promotion? Paul Bosch was one of the sweetest, nicest promoters in the world. And he had a gentleman's agreement with Paul Bosch and went right out in the ring and just as much as said, up your butt. And Paul Bosch came into the dressing room furious and just chewed the man's butt out, gave him another chance the following week and said, now do I have your handshake or the gentleman's agreement? And he says, yeah. And they went out the following week and screwed things up again.
I know there's a lot of stories out there on Bruiser Brody that Bruiser was this and Bruiser was that. And I know that there are stories about Bruiser, but I never saw that. And Bruiser never did anything but draw me a lot of money. He was a friend I could count on. He never said no on the big things.
I know he was a hard man to deal with. And I actually applaud him for that. I applaud these guys who stood up to the promoters and demanded, because as you know, following the business all the years you've had, you know the promoters just bury wrestlers. We were nothing but pawns in
right.
the game.
With nowhere to go in the U.S., he left to wrestle in Australia. It was here, while working for Jim Barnett, that Goodish met his future wife, Barbara, a hotel receptionist.
It was months and months before we would talk as they were going through the foyer or as they were going through their matches, and it kind of just evolved from there.
Within a few years, Barbara moved with Goodish back to the U.S., and the two were married and had a son named Jeffrey. Despite his maniac stage persona, Goodish loved being the supportive father to his son.
He wanted to spend more time at home, but of course, this is what he was working up to when he was trying to get things, when Jeff was 7, 8. Jeff was at that age where he was starting to need his father, and Frank was trying to do things so that he could get home more, but of course in life, sometimes even the best way plans don't work out. But the summer before everything happened, he spent more time with his son and myself than he had at any other time. So I am very grateful for that time that we did have. It was the best time and the most time that we had spent together even since Jeff had been born.
Eventually, work came to Brody in the States again with Fritz Von Erich and his world-class promotion and with Sam Muchnick in St. Louis. But it was Japan that really opened the doors for Brody as far as making the big money of his career. He worked for Giant Baba's All Japan promotion, where he was both feared and admired by the Japanese fans. He also reunited with his old West Texas State pal, Stan the Lariat Hansen.
We were 300 pounds, and we could go, and basically nobody else could go like we could go. And that's what made us a good team, I think.
He said a lot of the Japanese boys would just beat up the American boys. He says, well, Hansen and I got there. He says, we're the ones who did the beating up. Nick Bockwinkel told a story once that he and Jim Brunzel were working a match in Japan against Brody and Hansen. And Nick said, I tried to explain to Jim, this is going to be as close to a shoot as you're ever going to have in your life.
He had a mentality about, like, when what the perfect spot in a match is to throw the real stiff kick to where everyone will ooh and ah and believe you're real. And at other points in the match, you don't do it because you don't want to hurt the guy, but you may have to do it. You know, like, it's kind of like this mentality of you have to do it once because then they know you're dangerous and you get that dangerous thing going with you.
Those fans looked at that and they went, ooh, Brody for real.
Former world champion Hulk Hogan.
I don't think he was a bully, but he was just really weird. He knew it was a work, and because he knew it was a work, he took it to his advantage. You know, he says, well, I'm not doing a job, or I'm not doing this or that or the other. He knew it was a work, but he wasn't a good businessman.
These two had been very loyal to each other, and it has often been speculated in wrestling that Bruiser Brody and Stan Hansen made a secret pact to stay together as a team when they first started out together in Bill Watts' Mid-South territory.
Somebody once said that him and Stan Hansen took a vow to screw up every promotion they could. And in essence, whether that's true or not, I don't know.
If you think this relationship between me and Stan Hansen ain't strong, you ain't smartened up not one little bit. Get ready, Bill Watts, to dust your butt off in that ring.
When you first start out, you cling to any kind of success you can. And a lot of times that clinging is developed out of lack of confidence because you really don't know how good you're going to be yet, you know. So you cling together. And that's what they were doing. And they were an impressive team, but they were holding each other back.
That may have been once they became superstars. I don't think it was you know, from the Mid-South days, mm-hmm. or not from the McGurk days.
Two times I met him, and one time I actually went to his hotel room in Japan. He was staying at a small hotel when he worked for Bob, and we talked about doing some stuff together. And it was just a weird deal because I was partners with his old partner, Stan Hansen. And for a couple of years there, Stan kind of didn't want me and Bruiser to become too friendly. But then when Stan went his own way, I always thought there would have been a spot for me and him to work together, but it never happened. I really wish that would happen somewhere in my career.
Yeah, well, you know, that's true. You know, we looked out for each other because, you know, I mean, we knew that we lacked certain abilities, you know, in the wrestling ring. But so we were just, yeah, we had a little pack that, you know, if anybody really, you know, ties me up and starts, you know, hurting me, that I'd help him out and he'd help me out.
Now that Brody had guaranteed income from Japan, he was able to call the shots with promoters in the States, working only for those he wanted to and very rarely doing a job. Most wrestlers were hurt by Vince McMahon destroying the territories and killing off places for them to work, but Brody managed to escape that since he had his gigs in Japan and now Puerto Rico.
It was getting harder and harder at that point in his life for him to go on the road as much as he did. That's one of the reasons he had Japan. At least when he was there, he made so much money that he didn't have to do a whole lot over here. He could pick and choose his spots. And he kind of did Puerto Rico with easy money, and as the independents were drying up, he just jump in there.
After debuting for Puerto Rico's World Wrestling Council group in 1983 as a heel, Brody turned face in 1987 and continued working there until the night of July 18th, 1988. Puerto Rican wrestler and booker Dutch Mantel.
Puerto Rico always had a different feel to it because it was rough. It was brutal. I mean, I've been hit by those people. I fought them. I went to the hospital one night. I went to two hospitals one night when they all attacked me and brother. But anyway, when I said there was tension, there was tension just going into the arena. But even when I walked in the dressing room that night, it still had an eerie feeling, and I've always had an extra sense of when I could feel danger.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a very eerie feeling that night.
On this night, Brody arrived at the stadium in Bayamon, Puerto Rico, shortly after 7 p.m. He spent some time talking to fellow worker Dutch Mantel in the dugout. He went out and sized up the crowd. The same things he would do at any show. At one point, the promoter and one of the workers, the man Brody had embarrassed in New York, Jose Gonzalez, called Brody over for a private chat in the shower. This was not uncommon for talent and Booker to talk before a match to discuss the finish and other matters. What was uncommon was that Gonzalez had his hand wrapped in a large white towel.
He asked him to go into the shower to talk business, and I wasn't even in there when that was said because I don't like sitting in dressing rooms, especially I don't like sitting in dressing rooms in Puerto Rico, so I had walked down to the dugout, down this long hallway, this baseball stadium, and I sat in the dugout for 3 minutes, 4 minutes, no more, and I was just watching the crowd come in, and it looked like it was going to sell out. So when I walked back up that tunnel, it had already happened. And Frank was laying on the floor of the dressing room, and there was a lot of noise. There was a lot of shouting, a lot of screaming. It was chaos in there. It really was.
Moments later, loud screams filled the locker room, followed by Gonzalez fleeing the scene in a blood-soaked white shirt. Brody stumbled out with a 3-inch stab wound, trying to hold his stomach together. The ambulance took over 20 minutes to arrive, and Brody was losing blood at an alarming rate. In fact, he would die on the operating room table because he had lost so much it couldn't clot.
You don't think that you're going to get stabbed to death in the dressing room. I was in wrestling for 30 years, and I saw a lot of fights, but I never saw one take out a knife.
Puerto Rico, you know, they play by different rules there.
Gonzalez went ahead and murdered Bruiser. There is no reason to ever kill a man.
They said, listen, it's sad what happened to Bruiser Brody. I says, no, it's not sad what happened to Bruiser Brody. What's sad is what happened to Bruiser Brody's family and children and wife, because he took himself down to Puerto Rico, and he had an obligation to his family. And as far as I'm concerned, he was screwing around with his family just as well as he was screwing around with the wrestling profession.
Right.
And he ran into a Puerto Rican, Bruiser Brody.
I told Bruiser before he went over there, I said, Frank, if you're going to Puerto Rico, change your attitude, because if you don't, you're not going to live to get off the island.
I know there had been money problems where there had been a check or two that had bounced. I don't doubt, although this is pure speculation on my part, I don't doubt that somewhere during the trip when he was down there, Brody said, you better get that blank, blank money together
right,
and have it for me before I go off this island.
Brody got in this habit of hijacking the promoter for more money, or he would walk out on the show. And I believe in my heart that that's what got him killed, which was a horrible thing. I don't advocate that anybody should do that. But, you know, it's funny. You reap what you sow.
Barbara Goodish received the fateful news after not one but two phone calls. The first one was the one she received telling her of the stabbing, which she didn't believe. The second was hers to Dutch Mantel, who sadly had to confirm that the story was true.
When Barbara landed in Puerto Rico with her 7-8-year-old son Jeffrey with her, in shock, because she didn't know yet that he was dead. She just knew he had been hurt, that it was Abdullah who ran into her at the airport and told her, Frank is gone. What a horrible thing to have told you at the airport.
Yeah.
And then Abby went and got on a plane. That does bother me.
At the funeral for Goodish, his son Jeffrey told his mother that he would not embarrass his father and cry.
The scariest thing, I guess, to me in retrospect, may have been a month roughly before he was there. He was in between planes in St. Louis, so I just went over and met him, spent a couple hours talking, bouncing ideas. And he kind of got real serious, and he says, Jeffrey wrote this, his son Jeffrey, wrote this little essay for first or second grade, just something about, and he wrote this thing about what would happen if Daddy didn't come back. We got talking about how lonely it was for Barbara and Jeff when he was on the road, and it was getting harder and harder at that point in his life for him to go on the road as much as he did. That's one of the reasons he had Japan. At least when he was there, he made so much money that he didn't have to do a whole lot over here. He could pick and choose his spots, and he kind of did Puerto Rico with easy money, and as the independence were drying up, he just jump in there. So he had this thing from Jeffrey, what I would do if Daddy didn't come home. And he basically said, we'd be very sad, but Daddy said we should go on. And we go on. So he tells me this story. He says, yeah, he says, I'm really proud of you. He says, but man, he takes my arm and he says, man, Larry, it kind of scared me. And then 4 weeks later, he was dead.
In a complete mocking of the justice system, Jose Gonzalez was able to use his own TV show to cast himself in a positive light and was acquitted for the murder of Frank Goodish. At one point, the sick Gonzalez even participated in an angle where he was billed as the man who had murdered Bruiser Brody. He still works in Puerto Rico today as Invader Number One.
The whole thing about the Brody thing is like nobody testified or no American testified against Invader. But I remember I knew the verdict before I got the subpoena and heard the verdict. Next day in the mail, my subpoena came.
I mean, I didn't see the trial. Everyone's heard the different stories, you know, of the guys getting subpoenas after the trial's over and stuff like that and the case. And, after about a week when or 2 weeks when the shock started wearing off, I never expected that you know, anything would happen. It was almost like, you know, you've been told so many times that a Puerto Rican kills an American and he's going to get away with it. So like when he did, I mean, it wasn't any, I just remember at the time it was like, okay, you know, that's what I figured.
Carlos Colon lost his business in essence because we wouldn't go because of what happened to Brody. I mean, and there was a lot of us, you know. I mean, there was a lot of big-time guys that had a lot of exposure on TBS and World Class, and we just wouldn't go. And the guy that committed the murder got off scot-free.
The legacy of Bruiser Brody is seen in almost every big man that continues to appear in pro wrestling. Yet no one has ever approached his level, mixing both a strong brawling style with that of technical wrestling. And after being gone for 18 years, he is still both missed and revered by performers and fans around the world.